أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
الحمد لله رب العالمين.
All praise is due to Allah, Lord of the world.
الرحمن الرحيم.
The entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
مالك يوم الدين.
Sovereign of the day of recompense.
إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين.
It is you we worship and you we ask for help.
اهدنا الصراط المستقيم.
Guide us to the straight path.
صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
The path of those upon whom you have bestowed favor, not of those who have evoked your anger or of those who are astray.
Everybody, Professor Beaver,
I'm here.
Do you have my voice?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Good night. Thank you. Hello, everybody, our dear guest, and especially Professor Beaver from University of California, Berkeley. Mark Beaver is professor of political science and director of Center for British Studies in California Berkeley University. I'm thrilled to have with us Professor Poul Ezzat. He's a full professor of public management at Tehran University, and also the head of the School of Governance and Iranian former Ministry of Trade, Mine, and Industry, Professor Adam Ferry, as a viewer. And I'm David Karim Poor from Iran National University, that will talk about the theory of governance by Mark Beaver. Mark,
hello?
Mark, we will have an introduction to the School of Governance by Dr. Poul Ezzat. We will discuss about your book and your view of point in book. Dr. Kazanferi will guide us an introduction of the School of Governance. Dr. Kazanferi. Unfortunately, we don't have Dr. Kazanferi's voice. Yet we have a short introduction of the School of Governance as the first a school of governance in Iran that is handling and is publishing and the researching on variety of aspects of governance in Iran as a one of the most prominent schools in Iran. Mark Beaver, Professor Beaver.
Hello.
Yeah. Let me tell you about the sense of and the organization of today's discussion. At the first, we will listen to your voice and your introduction of your book as a half of hour. After you, Professor Furezad will overview your the part one of your book, Philosophy. Then Professor Kazanferi will overview your part two, the School of the Theory of Governance. And the third part will overview by me, David Karimpour. And then we will again listen to your responses and to your viewpoints. Okay? Just please go on. Please, you are eagerly listen to your voice and your introduction by the theory of governance. Your book.
Okay. Thank you very much for organizing this conference. I'm very honored that you're so interested in my work. It's a proud moment when one's scholarly work attracts such attention, particularly when it's in a country other than those in which I myself have worked. So thank you very much. I'm very grateful. I thought, after some preliminary emails, that I'd talk a bit about three things. Firstly, what governance is, what the new politics is. Secondly, my particular theory of governance. And thirdly, how this relates to concepts of good governance.
Thank you.
So, to start with what governance is. What is governance? I think there are two or three main ways in which we can approach this question. One way is to ask about the contrast between government and governance. What is the difference between government and governance? And I think governance has three main different focuses from government. So the first is the concept of governance concentrates more on processes than on institutions. Most traditional approaches to government have focused on the institutions of the president, the parliament, the judges, the courts. In contrast, governance is often interested in the processes by which policy is made and the processes by which policy is implemented. The second distinction is that governance draws our attention, therefore, to the role of non-governmental actors in the policy process. So whereas government, if we just look at government, we're going to be looking at the big governmental organizations and their role in policy. If we look at governance, we're also going to be interested in the role of private sector organizations and voluntary sector organizations in the formation and implementation of public policy. And the final difference arising out of those two is that governance draws our attention to the fact that policy making is something that happens not just in the big institutions of government, but also in civil society. And that's why you can talk about things like corporate governance or healthcare governance, because organizations like hospitals, doctors are involved in creating a healthcare system of governance in alongside government. So government draws our attention to the way in which all these different actors contribute to creating a public policy and the way in which it works. The second way of thinking about governance is, I think, to talk less about a contrast with government and more about the way in which government has changed in the last, say, 40 years. And that's to use governance in a way that talks about a new governance. So there's a suggestion that we have one type of governance which dominated up until, let's say, 1980, and since about 1980, a different system of government has arisen. And that's what governance refers to. So I think if we're talking about the idea of a new governance or a new politics, governance draws our attention again to three or four different features, three or four ways in which governance has changed in the last 40 years. The first is governance is now more hybrid than it used to be. Governance is more hybrid than government. That is, it involves different types of organizations in different types of relationships to one another. So government used to mainly involve departments of state, bureaucracies, in fairly hierarchical relationships. In governance, what you find is different organizations relating to each other, partly within bureaucratic hierarchies, but also within markets, quasi-markets, and networks. The second difference is that governance is more multi-jurisdictional than government. That is to say that governance covers a wider range of areas with a wider range of organizations. And the third, again, a related difference, is that governance involves a wider range of stakeholders. When I was much younger, we used to think about the stakeholders in government as the main political parties, the government actors, the departments of state, and they were really elected, and then they went about the process of ruling. Governance emphasizes that the process of ruling often involves those actors working with other organizations, again, with hospitals, with organizations of doctors, with international agencies, with regional bodies. So again, it draws our attention to the fluid and diverse nature of government. I'm just going to quickly, in the type your message, type in the key words I've just used to suggest that how government differs from government. So governance is hybrid, multi-jurisdictional, and involves different stakeholders and relies on networks. And I think those are the main features we would generally say distinguish the new politics of government from an older politics that predates it. And then I think, having talked about what the new governance is and how conceptually it differed from government, I thought I'd say a little bit about how this generally arose.
Professor Beaver, there's a question about the effectiveness of these two kind of governing. You know, you talk about government and governance, yes? But
yes,
there is a question that really and actually the networks and markets really are the effective tools for govern and solving social and political economic problems or not. Is it the problem of government is just hierarchical structure of governing or not? There are another problems that we do not know now.
Yeah. I think there are two questions there. One question is the new government actually just a tool of government? So does the new government genuinely involve networks and markets in a way that allows other organizations to affect public policy? Or is the new governance just a tool by which governments now try to achieve their purposes? And I think the answer is probably that it's both. And then the second question is, how effective are markets and networks? And I think that's a really difficult question to answer. I think that how effective they are varies across policy sector. It varies across geographical location. I don't think they're a panacea. I don't think they solve all our problems. I think they create as many problems as they solve. I think probably a more diverse practices is good, but I definitely don't want to suggest that markets and networks are the answer, that they resolve the difficulties of forming and implementing policy. So then I was going to talk a bit about how this arose, and I think it's useful analytically to distinguish three different waves of reform that have created the system of governance that dominates, particularly in Western democracies today. And the first wave of reform was neoliberalism. Again, I'll type the names of these waves up. The first wave of reform was neoliberalism, and it was really about spreading markets, marketization, contracting out, and what was called the new public management. The second wave of reform, I think, came from a very different place. If the first wave of reform was about markets, the second wave of reform was by people who thought that the markets hadn't really worked, and moreover would not work, and that what was needed instead was networks. So I call these networks. And I think those if the first wave of reform, neoliberalism, was associated with, say, Ronald Reagan in America, Margaret Thatcher in Britain, the World Bank very much led a series of reforms to spread markets globally. The spread of networks was associated more with Bill Clinton in America, Tony Blair in the UK, and internationally more with the post-Washington consensus. And then I think we're now in a world which is slightly different from both of those, and I'm going to use the word hybrid again here to capture the third one. And I think we're in a world now where people think markets are quite useful, networks are quite useful, but neither really solves everything. And people are looking around for alternatives. And I don't think any one agenda dominates. I think by and large, people are still creating networks and deliberately doing so, but they're trying to make the networks they create more responsive to citizens. So we've seen the rise in the last 10 years of concepts like community governance and co-production, both of which are not just about creating networks between different organizations within the state. They're explicitly about trying to connect organizations within the state to citizens. And I think that is something new and deserves to be picked out as such. So I think that in some ways it's not very helpful because it's not a one-sentence definition of governance, but I hope it captures some of the complexity that I think governance refers to. It really refers, governance describes an ongoing process of change in which policymakers are trying to dismantle or at least weaken traditional bureaucracies and replace them by markets, networks, systems of community governance, and systems of co-production. And then I thought,
Mark, excuse me, you mean that the governance and the markets and networks are just helpful for some special matters and issues, and not for all matters? Yes, you mean that?
Yes, that's right. And then I thought I'd talk a little bit about my particular theory of governance, but not too much. So I think it's useful to distinguish two main theories of governance, one relating to markets and the other relating to networks, which were the dominant theories when I started to write about governance. So the first theory we might call a rational choice theory of governance. And this presupposes that policy actors are self-interested and act to maximize their own benefits. And it then models political processes as though that was true. A rational choice theory of governance need not always lead to the promotion of markets. But generally speaking, the rational choice theory has led to attempts to introduce market mechanisms and contracts. And it's also led to an emphasis on what's called non-majoritarian institutions. So rational choice theorists will emphasize that electoral democracies can have suboptimal outcomes, and they can therefore want undemocratic institutions that will produce better outcomes. The most famous example of that is central banks. So rational choice theorists will emphasize that voters will vote for more spending on their pet projects, and that that's bad for the collective financial prospects of the state, and therefore they want the central banks to be independent of democratic control. The second theory of governance we might associate with institutionalism. And institutionalists tend to emphasize that policy actors act in accord with their institutional roles. So they tend to see policy and politics as very sticky or stable. And as a result, they've argued that the attempt to introduce markets has instead often produced networks. But they've also argued not only that the reforms have produced networks, but also that networks are good. So if rational choice theory has tended, broadly speaking, to support markets, institutionalism has tended, broadly speaking, to support networks. And then the third theory I'm going to mention is my own, which I call, as you will know if you read the book, theory. And a decentered theory focuses not on the self-interest of actors and not on established sticky social roles, but instead on the way in which diverse actors act and thereby make policies and implement policies in accord with diverse, often conflicting sets of beliefs.
Mark, excuse me, how can we ignore the self-interest of the actors? The real politics shows that we cannot ignore and neglect, and we cannot specify the self-interest of countries and actors in both domestic politics and international politics. So how can we solve this dichotomy between the self-interest of actors and government and the center theory of governance that you are discussing about it?
That's a very good question. And I don't want to deny self-interest. I want us to rethink it. So So I don't deny that people are self-interested and often act on their own interests. But I want us to see that their self-interests aren't simply given to them. They understand their self-interest within their wider set of beliefs. So, for instance, I might think that my self-interest is to become as rich as possible, or I might think my self-interest is to be as happy as possible. They're different ideas. And if I think my self-interest is, say, to be as rich as possible, I still have to have a view of the world which will tell me how I can become richer. So I'm not denying that people act on self-interest. I'm just insisting that the concept of the relevant concept of self-interest is not the formal one we find in rational choice. Instead, it allows that people's views of their self-interest depends on their wider webs of belief. So if I were to summarize the view that my theory generates, I think it encourages us to see governance, the spread of markets and networks, as an elite agenda inspired by elite ideas, elite beliefs, and to recognize also that that agenda confronts all sorts of resistances from people who hold different beliefs. So if I could just give one very quick and simple example. The World Bank has, over the last 30 years, tried to promote governance and good governance, for instance, in Africa. And it has done so by emphasizing the importance of markets and networks. So there you have an elite agenda, a belief in markets and networks, being promoted by the World Bank. But within Africa itself, that agenda has often met with a fair degree of skepticism. And policy actors, local policy actors, have often been willing to say, oh yes, we really like the idea of governance, because by saying that, they will get World Bank funds. But they don't really share the beliefs of the World Bank elite, so they don't implement the policies that they're then meant to. Instead, they pay lip service to the policies whilst actually resisting them.
Thank you. Mark, as a question I have for your introduction, you have talked about weak problems in your book, yes? Weak problems. So we are facing with coronavirus breakdown in all of the, you know, all around the world, especially in USA and Iran and other countries. So do you believe that really, actually, that the networks and markets as a new model of governance can solve these risk problems or not? You know, today's the coronavirus is going to be the global crisis for all peoples in all around the world. So the networks and markets, how can solve these kind of problems that are known as a silver crisis?
I think, in my opinion, markets are extremely unlikely to solve wicked problems.
Mm.
I don't think they're going to. I think networks can help. But although they can help, I don't think they are always going to work, and I don't think they are inevitably a solution. And I would emphasize, personally, so I think markets don't work, networks sort of work, but not very well. And I think really we need to rely much more on processes of dialogue and participation if we're actually to address many of the main problems we confront today. Which brings me to the final bit of my introduction. So what is governance was the first bit. My particular theory in relation to other theories was the second bit. And the third bit I thought I would talk about is how this relates to good governance and therefore to solving those sorts of problems. And one way into that is to go back to the the three theories I mentioned. I'm really trying to say that we have three main options. In fact, I think we probably have only three options conceptually. The first option is rational choice theory. And let me step back for a moment. I want to talk here about problems that from an academic perspective would be described as problems of a micro theory. That, by that, I mean, how are you going to explain the actions of the individuals that create institutions? So everybody, rational choice theorists, institutionalists, me, we all agree that there are things that look like institutions. What we want to know is how we would explain why those institutions are what they are. So one option, the first option, is the rational choice form of explanation, the rational choice micro theory. Rational choice theorists try to explain political institutions by saying people are rational self-interested actors, and by using a purely formal concept of rationality. The second option is institutionist. Institutionists really try to ignore the question of micro theory. They just want it to go away. And when they do address it, they tend to want to say that people just act out social roles, which we all know is false. We all know it's false because we all know, if we think about ourselves, that there are norms that attach to our role, but that we have a choice about how to interpret those roles and whether to follow them. So we know that at best, institutionalism is a simplification. It's not actually true as a micro theory. It might be a useful simplification, but it's not actually true. And the fact that it's not true explains why, over the last 30 years, there has been, in much social science, a rise of economic and rational choice perspectives in place of older sociological and political science perspectives. And the third option is my own theory, which is, to some extent then, an attempt to offer an alternative micro theory which institutionalists might, if they want, appeal to. And my theory is that people act on their beliefs, and they're fairly rational, but that their beliefs are contingent and historically constructed, and that what is rational for them depends upon those contingent historical beliefs rather than on some purely formal concept of rationality. So if I work or talk now about those three options and apply them a little bit to good governance. So the one thing I haven't talked about is the notion of good governance, and that is almost a separate part of the history of governance. So everything I've been talking about up to now has really been in the academic world of public policy. The concept of good governance arose in a very different world, that of a very different academic world. It arose in the academic world around economic development. And good governance was a concept that sought to suggest that development outcomes depended upon having a good political system. So the very simple idea was that if an organization like the World Bank donated a lot of money to a country X, but that country's political system was full of corruption, then the money donated by the World Bank or the IMF would disappear into the hands of corrupt politicians rather than being used for social purposes. So the argument was, if we want to improve development outcomes, we need to think about good governance. And the concept of good governance originally was a bit of a half-hearted concept, in that really it was a Western liberal concept, but a lot of people proposing it didn't want to associate it straightforwardly with Western democracy, because then it might have been opposed by some of the countries they hoped would adopt it. So the concept of good governance originally tended to pick on features of liberal government without emphasizing democratic elections. So it emphasized things like rule of law, stability, human rights, other such things.
Mark, I will talk to you on good governance, but let me invite Professor Ghazanfari and Professor Prezat to overview your book, and let's now see Professor Prezat's viewpoint to part one. Dr. Prezat, we are waiting for your notes and your viewpoint.
Good morning, everybody in Iran, and good evening, Professor Bever. First of all, I would like to thank you for your valuable presence in this meeting. I'm very happy to talk to you, and I can benefit from your knowledge and your theoretical approach to governance. I have three important questions that your answers to which can be valuable for me to lead to more specific discussion in the future. First question, how can we observe rationality in the perspectives of the people, that is, while people observe their individual interests and have to right to choose freely, how can society be led to a rationality oriented toward a better future? Two, perhaps it can be said that today, with the failure of many fundamentalist ideological approach or many radical ideologies in the world, a suitable space has been provided for the replacement of rationality and knowledge instead of ideology. How correct is this perspective? Three, it is obvious that when designing any kind of governmental system, we significantly challenge the future of the world and the lives of the future people. How can consider and preserve the possibility of reconsideration for next generation while trying to improve our governance model?
Shall I reply to that now?
Yes.
Okay. Could you quickly repeat the third question for me?
Yes.
The third question, Professor, for that, please reply.
How can consider and preserve the possibility of reconsideration for next generation? In any kind of model of governance, we build and promote, any people may have a right to revise it. How can we consider this right of revise?
Professor Mark, excuse me, you have just 5 minutes to respond.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So on the first question about how should we think about rationality in creating a better future, actually, I think I'll answer the second question first. Do I think that rationality is replacing ideology? In a sense, yes, I do. In a sense, I do think that our scientific knowledge of things like the climate, I do think there is a growth of scientific knowledge, and I do think it is kind of playing a role in policy. So in a limited sense, yes, I do think rationality is replacing ideology. And moreover, I'm optimistic that it will continue to do so, and that it will do so as an international agenda. Because we all switch on lights, we all get on aeroplanes, so we all have to believe in some level in science. So some things about science provide a basis for shared beliefs, which I think does offer a kind of basis in rationality that replaces ideology. But in other respects, I don't think so. And in particular, I think that the kind of formal expertise that is associated with the social sciences, rather than this, is often actually just a form of ideology. So I think, for instance, that to some extent, rational choice theory is just an American view of the world imposed upon the world. I don't think it's an accident that rational choice theory best fits the US Congress. Americans are particularly inclined to act as rational choice suggests people should act. People in other parts of the world are much less so. So I think that the natural sciences do offer a basis for rationality that is growing in public policy, but I think that the social sciences, it's often something that is actually yet another type of ideology creating policy. That brings me to your first question about how we can expand rationality to create a better future. And I think the main problem with the social sciences is that they rely on formal explanations and formal understandings. So they model people's behavior in accord with a formal model of rationality, or they look at institutions as though people are bound to follow formal roles. And I don't think those sorts of formal approaches are deeply flawed. And I think instead, as I suggested earlier, we need to understand that people act on their own beliefs, and that their own beliefs can be diverse, and that they arise in different historical contexts. And I think that means a more rational, a better approach to public policy would rely less on formal social science and more on dialogue with different policy actors, asking them what they believe, how they're likely to react to certain policies, whether they approve of these policies, whether they'll oppose them, what will happen if the policies are introduced. So I actually think, yes, there is a spread of rationality, but crucially, if we're to make much progress in the future, we need to move from formal expertise to more participatory dialogue, recognizing that different people see the world in different ways and have different attitudes to the world, and that we need to find ways of engaging them from the perspective they currently take. I wish I had a good answer to the next generation question. I think I'm very pessimistic about the environmental future that we all face. And I wish I had a solution. I'm afraid I don't. I'm a pessimist about environmental prospects.
Thank you, Mark. I invite Professor Kazan Feri to... Dr. Kazan Feri? Dr. Kazan Feri?
Yes, I'm here.
You're invited for your viewpoint.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Bibir. I'm so glad to see you here. And let me just say good morning to all Iranian guys here, and good night to you. Actually, it was very beneficial for me to hear from you regarding the decentralized government theory. That I hope it much help us to have a better future. I read your book. It is so invaluable. And I provide some question regarding part two of your books, because we are just talking regarding your books now and not other issues. Let me start it from my first question in part two of your book. The tough universal challenges and disasters during 2000 and 2010 stress the role of a state to govern and solve problems. Financial crisis in 2009, massive migration around the middle of the second decade, especially toward the EU, and to the breakdown of COVID-19 all around the world are such an example that deny the reliability and effectiveness of a stateless state idea. Mr. Karim put a simple same question a few minutes ago. What do you think regarding the stateless state theory and solve such a problem, such worldwide problem we are facing now? It's my first question, and after hearing your answer, I started the second one. Please.
Okay.
Mark, please, you have 3 minutes to respond.
So I think I need to say something about my concept of the stateless state. So the concept of the stateless state is not meant to suggest that there is no state. Instead, it's meant to be a critique of people who treat the state as though it's unified. So I'm arguing that there's no essence to the state, that it has no single unified agenda. So the issue for me is not, are there bodies that collectively act politically? The question for me is there a single thing which is the state which has a single will? And I don't think there are single things that are the state that have a single will. Instead, I think the state is made up of diverse organizations, diverse groups, which compete with each other and often have different views about what state policy should be. So against that background, I think you're absolutely right. I think we faced a lot of issues recently which show the importance of what I will now call political action. So I think we definitely need collective political action, but I don't think that means that we need to conceive of the state as a unified entity with a unified will.
So you mean, extreme terminology and stateless state actually doesn't mean that there is no state.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I don't mean there's anarchy. What I mean is the state is made up of disparate actors which disagree and conflict with one another rather than all sharing a single perspective which we can define as the state or the state perspective.
Okay, thanks a lot. Let me just start with the second question. In part two of your book, The Transformation of Hierarchical Governments to Network and Markets is analyzed. But the question arises is how can the network and market govern without centrality? How could keep accountability of this market and network? It seems that hybrid governance is what makes account of hierarchical government as well as market and network model of governance. I think such a hybrid governance between the traditional governance and the new one may help us more. What do you think regarding this idea?
Yes, no, I think I probably agree. So the first thing to say is I don't think markets and networks have entirely replaced bureaucracy. On the contrary, I think bureaucracy is probably still the primary form of political organisation for states. But I think it's been increasingly replaced or supplemented by markets and networks. And I think, in addition, I think you're correct to say that the rise of markets and networks creates a problem for our traditional notions of democratic accountability. I think that's true. So representative institutions and bureaucracies have obvious lines of accountability, and markets and networks don't have such obvious lines of accountability. I think the moral of that, though, is not that markets and networks are necessarily bad. Instead, I think we need to recognise that representative democracy has a lot of long-established flaws. That doesn't mean that we should reject representative democracy. I personally quite like it, but it does mean we should see it as having flaws. And I think those flaws are best corrected by supplementing representative democracy with more participation. And if we introduce more participation, we obviously change what we mean by accountability. Accountability stops being straightforwardly accountability through representative institutions, and it becomes as well accountability through the direct participation of citizens and civic organizations in the policy process.
Okay, thanks a lot. As the last question, let me ask you regarding meta governance. It's the term recently discussed about. Actually, my question is how the development of market and networks will work under the authority of national states. Is metagovernance would be a real solution to maintain authority?
I don't think the concept of metagovernance is particularly helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just don't. I don't think it's helpful to think of the way governance operates as systematically different between federal-level organisations such as the European Union and the nations under it. I don't see why that's any different in principle from governance between a nation-state and its local government, between, say, Britain and the government of London. In both cases, what you have is different governmental agencies cooperating, conflicting, and also doing so in a setting where they have to collaborate with other organizations. So I think meta-governance is not a particularly helpful analytic tool. I think its main role is to provide political scientists who are particularly interested in the European Union with a way of talking about the European Union. And as a result, metagovernance doesn't appear as much in discussions of policy outside the European Union as do other contexts of governance.
You know, when we are talking regarding local government or national government, the theory you mentioned may work very well. When we are discussing multinational government, when there are many governments want to work to each other based on one theory, somehow we may need to develop the theory of meta-governance to make sure that all people around the world have a good lifestyle and happiness and so on. What do you think?
I agree with that, but I would use the phrase global governance.
Uh-huh.
And I would use the phrase global governance to indicate greater diversity and fluidity than would be associated with, say, global governments or just the United Nations. So I very much agree that we need to think about ways, forms of multinationalism, forms of dialogue between different parts of the world, mm-hmm. and how those help us to solve and address important global problems. I just wouldn't want to use the word multi-level governance to describe what I think is necessary there.
Do you think your Tory dissenters governance can act as a governance for multinational, worldwide zoom? I mean, not just in the national one. It works in
multinational. I do. I should type something in again. I think that the two main features of decentered theory apply as much to global governments as they do to national governments. So the first feature is to analyse governments by discussing the diverse beliefs of different actors rather than by formal forms of social science. And the second, which I think follows from that, is to think about addressing public problems through dialogue more than through formal expertise. And I think both of those apply to global governance as much as they do to governance within the state.
Okay, thanks a lot. Give the time to other people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Kazanfari, the head of the School of Governance and the Iranian former Minister of Industry, Mine and Trade. Professor Purezat, do you have my voice? Professor Purezat. Oh, it seems that Professor Purezat does not have my voice. Yes? Mark, go speak about your third part, new politics. I am a student of politics, assistant professor of international relations. You have talked on the third part about new politics, and you call the governance as a new politics, yes? So you have built your norms and your ideas and new liberalist ideas and norms. But today, we are watching that even the liberal democratic countries and liberal democratic systems are violating the new liberalist ideas, yes?
Yes.
Yes. How is your response to this dichotomy, to this problem, that we're watching that even the liberal democratic countries are not committed to the new liberalist ideas and norms? No, the Stiglitz in a distinguished article has talked about the end of neoliberalism and reverse of the new history, new world, new history. So, but you have discussed about neoliberalist ideas, norms, and values on your third part in new politics. So, would you please elaborate on your ideas? How can you respond to the ideas about end of neoliberalism and ideology?
I'm really arguing the same. So I'm really saying, if we go back to the very beginning of this evening's session, and I talked about the rise of governance, I think that the rise of markets through neoliberalism is something that really happened in, say, the 1980s. And then by the time you're in the 1990s, I think many states that are sometimes called neoliberal were actually pursuing networks and network governance and joined-up governance much more than what we might think of as marketizational neoliberalism. And I think also something similar was true about international agencies. If you think about the way in which the World Bank shifted to the post-Washington consensus about that time. So I actually agree. I think I don't know how best to put it. I mean, I think neoliberalism is a very overused word. I think it's an overused word because I think the left like to use it to complain about government. So the left wing like to use neoliberalism because it suggests everything is bad. I mean, virtually never hear anyone say, I am a neoliberal. It's a word that is used by critics. And I think it's a fairly inadequate word because it fails to distinguish the different ways of governance I was talking about, from markets to networks and then on to things like community governance and co-production. So I actually agree. I think we do live in a world which has long since left at least the heights of neoliberalism behind.
So if you agree with me to that point, so what is your alternative for neoliberalism's ideas and ideologies? What's your alternative ideas?
Well, as I've been saying, I would want to promote more participatory avenues and more dialogue. And I think I could add...
You mean that the participatory democracy and the dialogue democracy is not based on neoliberalism norms and ideas or not?
No, I don't think it is at all.
Yes.
I think it's based on very different norms. So, and I could say a little...
What are the norms? What are the norms you are discussing about it?
Neoliberalism is based on the norms that, crudely put, one, people are self-interested rational actors acting in accord with a formal notion of rationality, and two, therefore markets create optimal outcomes. Whereas my view is, one, people act on diverse beliefs which are reasonable and consistent in that they fit together, but they're not formally rational in the way that rational choice suggests. And two, therefore markets don't always create optimal outcomes, and instead we need to engage one another in dialogue so as to understand one another's perspective and how one another is likely to react.
Yes. Mark, for the last question that I have, I'm waiting for your response, is that let's go to the contemporary politics. You know, we are facing with the rise of protectionist policies and new mercantilist policies, you know, the new mercantilist policies in the country. So do you believe that the global governance that you have discussed on your book is a really achievable target, achievable aim or not, with a increasing rise of new mercantilist and really protectionist policies that the government, such as U.S. government, are setting for your for their actually policies and government.
What are you asking me about protectionism? Sorry.
No. I'm talking about the dichotomy and these problems that even liberal democracies are facing with. You know, you have talked about self-interest. You are talking about the participation and participatory democracies. We are talking about cooperation and markets and networks. Yes, but what? Yeah. The real politics and the contemporary politics are far from such ideas and such norms. So how can we achieve these norms and these ideas?
Yeah.
So really, what's the actual problems that contemporary politics has?
Yeah, I don't have an answer, I'm afraid. I guess I'm a utopian in that I don't have an answer, right? I mean, I don't know how much this resonates in Iran, but we have a contrast that we've inherited from Karl Marx between utopian and scientific. And scientific reforms were meant to be things that were attached to an agent, in Marx's case, the working class. And utopian reforms were things that you said, this would be a good idea, but you couldn't really give an obvious way in which it was going to arise. And I don't have an agent. I don't have one. I think that if I was being more optimistic than that, I would say that it seems to me that we confront a range of problems, and over time, people are adopting more participatory measures, and people are more and more aware of the limitations of formal expertise in the social sciences. And if we're lucky, those two things will mean that policymakers and elites turn to participation and dialogue. But I don't think we have a guarantee. I don't think we can know for a fact that this is going to happen.
Mark, thank you for your really beneficial response. There are another question that our audience ask you. Let me read first. The rational choice can explain and foresee the complexity of social system or not?
No. Because it assumes that people are rational, self-interested actors, and therefore, which they're not, right? Because they're rational, but as I was trying to say, what it is for them to act in their self-interest depends on their particular belief system, right? So someone who's very religious might think that their self-interest is best served by doing the will of God. Someone who's very materialistic might think their self-interest is best served by whatever makes them much money. And both of those then need to decide how they're going to interpret what God's will is or what will make them most money. So self-interest is actually defined in the context of people's diverse sets of belief. And rational choice ignores all of that complexity. So far from rational choice being able to explain complexity, rational choice is explicitly an attempt to simplify complexity.
Thank you. Mark, another question. What are the functions and roles of government in the modern governance theory? And what are the functions that other players and other actors, particularly private sector? And finally, how do you secure the roles and functions?
I can't give a simple answer to that because different approaches to governance would assign different roles to government and different roles to private actors. But probably the most common answer would be this. The role of government is to oversee the process, to define its ideals and define what outcomes it wants, and to pick what other organisations are to perform what roles. And then the role of other organisations is to try and deliver the outcomes that the government wants. So in other words, the role of government might be to say, we want to build 500 new houses on the outskirts of this city to house the poor. And then the role of a private sector organisation might be to build those houses when the government employs it to do so. So the government, generally speaking, is meant to define outcomes, and other organisations are meant to cooperate with the government in the delivery of those outcomes. That's not my view of what should be the case, but I think it would be a general view of what is the case.
Thank you. Mark, are narratives affect the utility function of people? How the emerging narratives may be managed?
Yes, I think they are. I mean, I think that's what I've been saying. So I've been saying that people's belief systems define what they think is rational for them to do. And I think another way of saying that is to say that people's narratives affect their utility function. So if I rewrote what I just said to you, a religious person might have a religious narrative, which means that their utility function is centered around doing the will of God. A heavily materialistic person might have a different narrative, which stresses the importance of getting wealth here on earth, which would mean their utility function would be centered around making money. So I think that's true. I think the main way you can manage or alter people's narratives is through persuasion and therefore through dialogue.
Yes. Mark, I did another question to the contemporary politics that we are facing in the today world. Our audience have another question about the poor and oppressed countries like Yemen. Yes? So what do you analyze? How can you analyze? How can you assess the good governance approach to the these countries like Yemen that are oppressed, are poor, and are under the dark?
I think the first thing to say is that there too I wish I had an answer, but I probably don't.
Yes.
I think that I don't want to disavow the traditional agenda of good governance. I think things like the rule of law, stable government are really important. And in too many parts of the world, they don't exist, including Yemen, right? I mean, you need the rule of law. And I was talking earlier about the stateless state. And if the state is stateless in the sense that the Department of Housing wants one thing, the Prime Minister wants another, you know, that's okay. But if you have a system where different bits of a country are ruled by warlords who are competing over resources and using violence, that's a disaster. So you know, I think that even not just the rule of law, but in many cases, getting greater capacity for states is important. In some ways, I quite support a fairly traditional and orthodox good governance agenda. But as I've been constantly emphasising, I would want to supplement that agenda with an emphasis on participation, social inclusion and dialogue, particularly with the poorest members of the states that we're talking about.
Mark, do you mean that this predicament, this weak problem that the Yemen is facing could be solved through governance, or it's not a really global will to solve such a problem, such a really human crisis?
Governance is a key part of the solution, but it is not the solution. The idea that just reforming state institutions is going to solve the problems is silly. And it's also often silly to imagine that a state can do that itself. In the case of places like Yemen, part of the problem, not all of the problem, but part of the problem in places like Yemen or Afghanistan, is that the state doesn't have the capacity to solve its own problems.
Just failed states, yes? I mean, there are failed states.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah,
go on. Do you have any other ideas?
No, but...
Another question is that, especially, what is the difference between policy analysis theories and governance theories?
To some extent, they can be used more or less as synonyms. So I can imagine schools in universities that used to be schools of public policy renaming themselves schools of governance. So policy analysis, governance, they can overlap. But they also can be quite different. So policy analysis tends to focus specifically on the analysis of policy, and moreover, it tends to look at the empirical analysis of particular policies. Governance tends to be something that can be employed not just about public policy, but also about organisations more generally. So you can talk about corporate governance, or healthcare governance, or clinical governance. And as a result, governance also lends itself more readily to being a word used for highly abstract social theories.
Thank you. Let's go to the other viewer, Professor Kazanferi. You have my voice? Professor Kazanferi?
Yes, I got it.
Yes, do you have any other idea? Do you have any other view of point to the Professor Beaver's discussion or not?
Actually, I have not any more question, but I think the audience have some others. If Mark has more time, please just mention the other question from audience.
I've asked the audience question now. I've asked all questions that audience issued to us.
It seems that there are some other questions in chat box. I just saw a few minutes ago.
Yes. I've asked all questions. There's no
other question. Let me just thank Professor Mark Beaver, and I just let him know that me as the head of Shahid Beheshti School of Governance just started 2 years ago. We have got a main goal that to expand the knowledge of governance in Iran, and we are experienced from 2 years ago, and one of our approach is to analyze the new books I have written in other countries regarding the how we can have a good approach to the government in Iran and some other countries. So it was very good time for me to hear from you, because we need to have more knowledge regarding the different theories for ruling the country and train the owner. Actually, we have got 3 different courses. One of them is short-term courses, maybe 1 week or 3 weeks, less than 1 month. In these courses, we prepare our governor to have a better function in the country. And we have got the long-term courses, that the PhD course, and it's about 4 years duration. And another way is something middle. Midterm courses, it's more than 1 month, less than 6 months. The third one is for young people to get familiar with different issue and topics and theories regarding the governing in Iran and some other countries. I would be happy if can I ask you regarding our mission in Iran, because we are a school of governance and we would like to make some patterns and benchmarks regarding other countries and get some advices from the people such as you. Could you just help us in this matter, or advise us some issue that you think is necessary, school of governance, to pay attention to that. How we can train better the young people, how we can ask the people who are in the parliament and in the state to listen to us to get more training courses, because actually the people who are ruling avoid to participate in the class and get new knowledge. It's a difficult task. Could you just advise us in this matter? Thank you.
I wish I could be more helpful than I'm likely to be. It's obviously difficult to say much about Iran when I know so little about it. I think that any institute of governance has to find a balance between 3 things and do its best with those 3 things. And one is promoting research from a range of perspectives on governance. And I think probably in a country like Iran, it's particularly important to focus on local problems and local issues within Iran itself. I think secondly, you have to take very seriously your educational mandate with students. You're obviously teaching people, some of whom, quite a lot of whom, might well go on to play a role in governance institutions, and equipping them to think more analytically and more abstractly about the problems they're then going to face is, I think, of immense benefit. And finally, I think there's the problem you mentioned of outreach and trying to make sure your work attracts some attention from policymakers, and perhaps also, I have no idea how you go about that latter one because I know so little, I'm afraid, about Iran. Can I end by saying not only thank you for hosting me, but thank you also, I'll put this in the comments, thank you also for speaking English. I'm aware that I sit here and I speak in my language and I try to speak more slowly, and I'm always immensely grateful for people who have put the effort in to learn a language that is my first language when I can't speak theirs. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Let me just ask my last request. I hope it should be the last.
Yes.
We have got PhD courses in School of Governance. Is it possible for you to just participate as a professor in one course and just from distance learning, teaching us some of our students regarding your books?
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, it would depend on when and how, but yeah, and yes, probably. Berkeley also has rules about external teaching, so I would need to go through the appropriate procedures to do so. But yeah,
that's fine. I hope to see you in our courses here in Iran.
Yeah.
okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks all. Thanks, Beaver. Professor Beaver, thanks. Thanks you so much. Thanks, John Ocean, to join us, and to Professor Purezad. Professor Purezad, I'm also thanks Professor Purezad to join us and ask some questions from a overview of the part one. Professor Kazanferi, if you don't have any other questions or ideas, let's end the discussion.
No, I have no more questions. Thank you. Thanks a lot from you and Professor Bivir. I hope to have more cooperation in future, the same discussion, dialogue, or maybe some other way. Thank you a lot. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bivir. Good job, and have a good night. Thank you.